Earlier this week, I read this short and gut-wrenching Facebook post from a friend. Today she would have turned 20. All that we wonder and all the ache that we feel melting into one vast teardrop, its saltiness stinging the souls and staining the pages of the lives of those she left behind. My friend's teenage daughter took her own life a few years ago. I've been reminded as well that life in our tumultuous and uncertain times is contributing to a rise in the suicide rate. I want to invite you to listen in on a timely conversation with Dr. Karen Mason, author of the book Preventing Suicide, a handbook for pastors, chaplains, and pastoral counselors, on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Well, it's a pleasure for me today to welcome Dr. Karen Mason to our Youth Culture Matters podcast. I wish this was not a conversation we need to have, but I'm grateful for people like Karen who have become experts on one of the most difficult matters we face in our culture, the issue of suicide. And certainly it's on our minds because every now and then we have these statistics, these new statistics pop up on the news as departments of health and those who track such things will put them out there just to make us aware of what's happening. And we know many of us here who are listening, those of you who are youth workers, many of you who are parents, unfortunately, you know someone close to you who has gotten so hopeless that they've taken their own life, and many, many more who have thought seriously about taking their own life and maybe have attempted that as well. And so we want to talk about it. We think it's timely today because it's in the news again. And I'll just relay a couple of things quickly. Had a friend lose a son-in-law just in his very early 30s, young dad, three children ages four and under, and one child on the way. Very unexpectedly, just a few weeks ago, taking his own life and leaving a family behind. And to watch that, this family navigate that and the friends navigate that has been very, very difficult for sure. And in relation to the COVID issue, you might not expect this, but I have someone I know who is an administrator at a nursing care facility and is just getting eaten up right now by the regulations that have been placed on them in terms of confining or quarantining couples one from another, and then even the fear that exists because of the COVID crisis. And this person relayed to me that they actually have some elderly gentlemen on 24-hour suicide watch just because of how depressed they have become over what's happening. And so there's lots more that we'll talk about here related to our times and what's happening. But Karen, welcome. You're joining us from the beautiful North Shore of Massachusetts.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I'm so pleased to be here.
Yeah. Karen, tell us a little bit about what you're doing now. You're on the faculty at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. You have some background, obviously, in this and some expertise, and we are going to talk, just to let people know, about a book you wrote a couple of years ago called Preventing Suicide, a handbook for pastors, chaplains, and pastoral counselors, published by InterVarsity Press. As always, we'll put a link to the book so you can learn more about it. But give us a little bit of your background and how you came to, you know, focus a lot of your work and your ministry and your training of young pastors and others in terms of how to begin to respond to this.
Absolutely. So, Walt, I am a psychologist and have worked with, you know, a number of clients who are suicidal. I think that's where I first became interested in how do you really help someone navigate this very challenging situation that some people find themselves in? And then I worked for a couple of years at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, managing their Office of Suicide Prevention. And the thing that really hit me there was that we didn't know a whole lot about what faith communities and faith leaders do to prevent suicide. We knew that they were key to the whole process of suicide prevention as a whole. If you look at the whole society, we knew that, these faith communities and faith leaders were just so key, but we weren't sure how. And so when I had an opportunity to come teach at Gordon-Conwell, I said to myself, hey, that's what I want to research. So really in the last 14 years, I've been researching the role of faith leaders and faith communities in suicide prevention. And that's really been such a passion of mine that's come out of my background as a psychologist, but also working in the arena of suicide prevention.
Just kind of as a flyover, what are some of the realities about suicide in our world and in our culture right now that you think it would be important for us to be aware of?
Well, I think one of the main things I would say is that suicide touches different people in their lifespan in different kinds of ways. So I think oftentimes we have this idea that, going to your example about men in residential communities who are on suicide watch, sometimes we have this idea that only young people die by suicide. And certainly that's a grave concern. Suicide is the second leading cause of death among 10 to 34 year olds. So certainly this is a problem for young people. But at the same time, the higher numbers and the higher rates are going to be with middle-aged people. So when we think about the lifespan, it really touches people across the lifespan. The other piece is that oftentimes people have this idea that suicide really is something that women struggle with more. But at the same time, even though women and young women in particular attempt suicide at greater rates, actually males die more by suicide. So really, I think the sort of biggest bird's eye view I would take is just that suicide is an issue that affects a lot of people across the lifespan. And so we need to figure out how to come alongside people really in a very broad way.
Let me ask you this question, and somebody asked us this. I threw out on Facebook this week, that I was going to be talking to you on this podcast, and I gave people an opportunity to respond, are there some questions you'd like me to ask Dr. Mason? And so one of the questions that came up, I think it's just a basic question, for those of us who this has not been a personal reality perhaps that we've struggled with, we then struggle with understanding what is going through the head of someone. What are they thinking as they ponder this or decide, yes, I'm going to establish a plan here and I'm going to make an attempt on my life? I'm going to guess your answer is that there's as many things going through their heads as there are people who have these things going through their heads. But are there some general insights you could give us into sort of the process that people go through as they're pondering this?
Absolutely. So one of the things I think is very helpful to keep in mind when you're thinking about what's going on in a person's mind who's thinking about suicide, I think it's important to remember that a part of them wants to die, but a part of them also would like to try to figure out if there is a way to stay alive. So the mental calculation that goes on in people's minds is that they have tried so many ways to confront the challenging situation in your life, whatever that is, their lives, and they haven't been able to come up with a solution. And so they're just full of just what some suicidologists have called psych ache, just this ache inside their psychological selves. They're just confronted with that sense of hopelessness about being able to fix this psychological ache that's inside of them. And so they become convinced that there might not be a better way out of this aching psychology besides death. So they would like to find another way out, but they just struggle with understanding and having the hope that there really might be another way out. But at the same time, one of the things that I think is very important for us, those of us who come alongside people who are thinking about suicide, is just that there is that side of them that would be willing to consider life if they were able to have some hope about being able to make it through this very difficult situation. And the other kind of mental calculation that goes through their minds, I think, is, you know, because a lot of people believe that suicidal people are very selfish, but the mental calculation is, hey, people would be better off without me. I'm a burden in this situation that I find myself. And so my loved ones would be better off without me, which of course is not true. Absolutely not true. But the calculation that takes place is, my loved ones would be better off without me, and I really can't come up with other ideas for how to make it through this challenging life.
Hmm. So, you know, one of the things I've heard over the years is that people who make an attempt on their life, or who, you know, and I know we use the term complete a suicide, it's not that, and I think I hear you saying, it's not that death is super attractive. Death may not be attractive at all. It's just that it is at least a bit more attractive than continuing to live my life. Is that an accurate way of thinking about it?
Absolutely. So the sort of calculation that's going on is, I'm not sure if dying is better, but I'm willing to take a chance at that because I know that life is just unbearable.
Hmm. Now, I'd like to ask you two questions. I'll ask you them both at the same time. I'll see if I can remember both of them here. But the first one is, you know, when we talk specifically about young people, so let's talk about teenagers, I think even children, you know, preteens, because this is an issue there as well for certain, and even young adults. I want to ask about what some of the most common causal factors are, you know, what's been gnawing away at them in the short term or long term that has gotten to them to this point. And then if you would go to our present circumstances in our culture right now, we're dealing with political divides and a lot of yelling back and forth. We are dealing with a coronavirus pandemic and some of the fears that people have related to that. And we've been reading a little bit about that. We're dealing with issues of racism and injustice, and there's some conversation going on right now that's contributing to a rise, at least temporarily here, in suicides among particular groups. So first off, causal factors, generally speaking, for younger people. And then more specifically, the second part of the question would be, you know, just from where you sit, having expertise in this area, is there research that's showing, maybe it's a little too early, what some of our current situations are adding to this? Or just speculate, perhaps, just from your knowledge on this in terms of what's adding to the rates of suicide?
Yes. So some of, you know, the risk factors are going to depend on age, you know, because say for instance, COVID is going to affect working age people who have lost jobs differently than they're going to affect young people who aren't yet in that group of people who have are expected at least to have jobs. So the issues that that generally face young people are that can kind of tip them over the edge in terms of thinking about death are going to be the loss of relationships, right? Which are issues potentially during COVID-19, potentially during times of great divide, as you were saying. So any kind of relationship loss. Now, by the way, the relationship losses that are very difficult for younger young people are going to be, say, for instance, difficulties that parents are having, if there's more conflict at home, which potentially could happen during COVID or times of great divide. So loss of parental relationships, close parental relationships can be difficult when young people who are younger are in those home situations, but loss of romantic relationships, girlfriend, boyfriend, can be very difficult for a little bit older teens and young adults. So loss of relationships are just very difficult. Now, by the way, not all people who lose relationships are at risk of suicide, but that is one of the risk factors, one of the things that could potentially increase risk for young people, which could be part of what's going on during COVID or times of great divide. Certainly, if you're a minority in the United States who has experienced some of the difficult situations that minorities experience, those also can be risk factors that could be related to some of the increase in the suicide rate, for instance, for Black youth. That's a potential. One of the things that we know in terms of COVID is that calls to crisis centers have increased 800%. Now we don't
say that again. Did you say 800%?
800%. Wow. Yes. So certainly COVID has put an enormous amount of pressure on people. I think the social distancing has been very difficult for people. The uncertainty about how the country is going to get through this great challenge, the uncertainty about am I or one of my loved ones going to catch COVID, and is there going to be a bad outcome there? Just some of that anxiety, that sort of underlying anxiety that many people are experiencing during COVID, I think, I'm guessing, and we don't know, but I'm guessing is contributing to that rise in calls to call centers, to crisis centers. We don't know yet if the suicide rate is going to, there's a prediction that the suicide rate is going to go up. Of course, the suicide rate has been going up since, the 90s. So the expectation, at least unless we change that trend, is that that rate is continuing to climb. How COVID and some of the other disruptions currently are going to affect that, I don't know. I think there's a lot of question about that and a lot of interest in how that's going to play out long term.
Yeah. You mentioned the issue with minority youth, and specifically with what's going on now in our culture in regards to racism and how that's being brought to the surface. And there has been a lot of research that's been done on Black young people, Black youths, and the suicide rate. I just want to read some statistics here so we can be aware of this. Those of us who are working with students who this may be part of their reality. So in November of 2019, less than a year ago, a study in pediatrics found that the rate of suicide attempts for Black youths shot up an alarming 73% from 1991 to 2017, while suicide attempts decreased 7.5% for white adolescents. Let me read a couple of more here. Overall suicide deaths increased by 33% in the United States from 1999 to 2017, with rates increasing in all age groups, races, and ethnicities among both men and women. However, the greatest rates of increase have been seen among adolescents and young adults. And then one more statistic relating to Black young people. This year, the Journal of Community Health published a study showing that between 2001 and 2017, the rate of death by suicide for Black boys ages 13 to 19 rose 60%, while the rate for Black girls skyrocketed an astounding 182%. And I do remember years ago when we here at CPYU first started to talk about suicide in the youth population, there was a significant difference between the rates among white youth and the rates among black young people, significantly lower at that time in the African American community. Any speculation on why that is, and maybe some of why these shifts have taken place?
Boy, that's a million-dollar question right there. One of the things that you want to always look at when you're thinking about suicide rates is what are the risk factors, right? What are the things that contribute to increasing that rate, but also what are the protective factors? And is that mix changing, right? So are there increasing risk factors? Are there decreasing protective factors? One of the things that I think is just so important is, in terms of protective factors would be those very stable, strong family relationships, religious engagement, community and social support, personal factors like academic performance and emotional well-being, stable family, housing, income, employment, all of those things are important in terms of protecting kids. So, my speculation is, I don't know, but my speculation is that something has changed in that risk and protective factor mix for these black youth who have this skyrocketing rate of suicide.
Yeah, and that's something certainly we'll want to track as time goes on. These are the kinds of trends that we need to be aware of, because as we're talking here with Dr. Karen Mason, we want to talk about preventing suicide. And we're going to take a break here. We're going to come back and continue our conversation. Stick with us. How has the coronavirus pandemic and stay-at-home order affected your family? One of the many good things that has come out of this crisis is that families are spending more time together. In fact, families are rediscovering the joy of sitting down at the dinner table together to share a meal and time in conversation. And as we navigate the questions, fear, and anxiety that have come with living in this cultural moment, we realize that our kids are ripe and ready to hear the truths of God's Word. We've been given a great opportunity to nurture our children and teens in the faith. Here at CPYU, we've launched a Family Table Talk initiative designed to provide your family with tools to help you dig deeper into and apply God's Word. We've recruited a team of gifted thinkers and writers to create several weeks' worth of Family Table Talk daily devotional guides. The guides give you a scripture passage to read together at the dinner table, some commentary on the passage to spark your thinking, some questions to help you apply and discuss what you've read, and a short prayer to pray together. These Family Table Talk devotional guides are all free. To access them for download and printing, simply go to our website at cpyu.org, that's cpyu.org, and click on the link for these brand new Family Table Talk guides. Well, welcome back, everybody, to Youth Culture Matters. I'm having a discussion today with Dr. Karen Mason, who is a professor at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, and she is she's a psychologist as well. She's been working in the mental health field since 1990, is an expert on suicide, and has written this book, so helpful for us in ministry, Preventing Suicide, a Handbook for Pastors, Chaplains, and Pastoral Counselors. So before we jump into looking at some of the ways that we can begin, the strategies we can use to begin this very conscious effort to prevent suicide in our ministries and in our families and our churches, I want to just ask you a little bit about, you were talking about risk factors and things, and some of the research that's been fascinating to me to come out over the years is what's called ACEs, A-C-E, Adverse Childhood Experiences. And the research that I've read on this is quite compelling. How would that, these factors that are in a child's life, how would awareness of those things be helpful to, let's say, a youth worker who is not a trained psychologist or counselor, but someone who can maybe be an observer who sees the initial, factors that would be present that might make this young man or this young woman more susceptible to thinking about taking their own life?
Mm-hmm. Well, and Walt, I just think you make such a good point. You know, that not, and we've been saying not everybody's going to experience a vulnerability to suicide exactly the same way, right? So the thing that adverse childhood experiences do in my mind, and here I'm going to be talking as a psychologist who has worked with a lot of suicidal people. The thing that I've noticed more than anything else is just this enduring self-hatred that people struggle with. And one of the sort of main adverse childhood experiences that's most associated with suicidal behaviors is exposure to childhood sexual abuse. And what maybe some people don't really understand is that having that boundary crossing, experiencing that boundary crossing, it results in a lot of self-hatred, which I think creates a lot of vulnerability for people in terms of crossing over into that line of making that mental calculation. Maybe I'm more of a burden to my loved ones than anything else. So those kinds of adverse childhood experiences are very much in the research related to increased vulnerability to suicide. And the way I make sense of that as a psychologist is just that boundary crossing just results in that enduring self-hatred, which I think is so antithetical to how we want to think of ourselves from a Christian perspective, right? Of being created in the image of God with worth and dignity, regardless of what it is that happens to us. But I think what's helpful about adverse childhood experiences from the point of view of a youth worker is just to, it helps you keep certain people on your radar, certain kids on your radar, right? So knowing that a young person has experienced difficult circumstances helps you keep in mind that there could be some vulnerability here.
That's good. Now, in your book, and right at the outset on page 18, and I found this to be very helpful, you provide a summary of some things we can do as pastors, chaplains, pastoral counselors, youth workers to help prevent suicide. Would you run through those and just explain a little bit about each? It's very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that has just been so compelling to me about why faith leaders and faith communities are so important in suicide prevention is how broadly they engage this issue of suicide. And because they engage it so broadly, they have so, that's where all the opportunity for suicide prevention comes. So the thing that has just so intrigued me as a psychologist is I tend to work in the area of intervention. I intervene with suicidal people who give me an opportunity to intervene with them, right? Not everybody does. Not everybody gives us that opportunity, but that's where I intersect with the issue of suicide primarily. Faith leaders and faith communities work in the area of prevention. I'll talk more about that in the area of intervention and in the area of postvention, what happens following a suicide. You know, clergy and faith communities just engage this issue so incredibly broadly, and there's so much opportunity there. So let me talk a little bit about prevention, intervention, and postvention. It shows up a little differently in the book, but as I've said, I've been continuing to do research, and so this is how I'm understanding it, especially today. So when we talk about prevention, one of the things that I think is so important is the theological pieces, the moral theology that we bring as Christians to suicide prevention. You know, we tell people to choose life. We tell people that God wants us to choose life. And we talk to people about how to do that and how to build lives worth living. We talk to people about how to have reasons for living. I can tell you, for me, you know, reasons for living revolve around this notion of God's love for me, that God gave his son, you know, paid a price, an immeasurably huge price for me, to redeem me. And that gives me hope that there's redemption for the difficult circumstances that I experience in my life. So God has given me tasks to do, and that gives my life meaning. All of those things are those prevention pieces that faith leaders and faith communities give to people who have that vulnerability to suicide. The other piece I'll add to that is just a safe, connected community. So having a community where you matter, where you belong, but also a community that is transparent enough for you to be able to reach out for help when you need it. A community where you expect to not feel judged, regardless of what it is that you're bringing up in terms of a conversation. So having a stigma-free community which allows that disclosure of suicidal thinking, I think, is just so crucially important. It is all part of that prevention package that faith leaders and faith communities bring. Then the next piece, talking about intervention, is, interestingly enough, people trust clergy. People go to clergy without going to see somebody like me, a mental health professional. They reach out for help to clergy. So clergy, I'll tell you, need to be skilled and equipped and have referral networks to be able to refer people to. But that is an intervention piece that faith communities and faith leaders offer to young people who are struggling. And then the whole piece about postvention, what happens after a suicide. So faith communities and faith leaders don't always do all of this, but at the same time, there's an opportunity to minister to the survivors, the people who are left behind following a suicide, to provide them the support that they need. Now, because of stigma, that doesn't always happen, but faith communities and faith leaders can do that. They can help their faith community heal following a suicide as part of that funeral or memorial service message. They can be concerned about contagion, or what some people call copycat suicides. They can monitor young people who are at greater risk for copycat suicides. So what I would say that is just so exciting about faith communities and faith leaders and suicide prevention, it's just the breadth of the ways that they experience and engage the issue of suicide, but also just all of those opportunities for how to intervene and how to prevent suicide.
Yeah. I love the way you break this down with prevention, intervention, and postvention. Let me get a little more specific in each of those, because I'm thinking about, and you've mentioned many of these things in terms of practical ways that a youth worker, let's talk specifically about youth workers, that youth workers can be involved in this. And I just want to emphasize a couple of things you said and ask you to comment on them. First, on prevention, you talked about, you know, basically communicating good news to them. You know, we have this ability to teach biblical truth that brings life, that advances our flourishing, that helps us understand who we are. Are there, in your estimation, specific truths, or I would venture to say even biblical doctrines, you know, as we study theology, that are especially helpful? You know, for me, I know in the COVID thing, there have been certain doctrines that I've really jumped into and immersed myself into to remind me and give me perspective in the midst of this, when it would be so easy to lose perspective because of all the things that are happening around us. Are there specific recommendations that you would make to a youth worker? You know, teach this.
Absolutely. And I'll give you just a little bit of a plug that my colleague, Dr. Scott Gibson, and I are have just finished writing a book about preaching and teaching about suicide, which is called Hope in the Darkness. I'll actually send a link to you so you can put it on your website. It's coming out here in September 2020. But we talk about those very specific doctrines. So let me just kind of walk you through some of those. So going back to what I was saying earlier about adverse childhood experiences, I think the worth and dignity of every human being is really important. And I think this comes up especially in discussions about physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. So quote unquote, you can't see me with my bunny ears here, but quote unquote, death with dignity acts. I have grave concerns about those because our worth and dignity as human beings aren't related to the amount of productivity that we have, right? But I think in our society, we get that a little bit mixed up. So the worth and dignity of every person, I think the notion of having a moral reason for why one ought to choose life is important. But at the same time, instead of just telling people, here's what you shouldn't do, I think we also need to give people those reasons for living. So I think that the whole doctrine of why we choose life as Christians is an important one. So the next piece I think that's so important is teaching a theology of suffering. And what I have noticed when I have talked to Christians about difficult situations they go through is that they are, first of all, maybe very surprised that they're in the midst of suffering. But, you know, suffering is all over the Bible, right? And so our theology of suffering needs to include the fact that suffering has existed for ages. But we need to also understand that suffering is not good in and of itself, right? Suffering's not going to exist in heaven. But it also is very painful. So one of the things, though, that I think is so important in our theology of suffering that we need to focus in on is hope. And we talk, you know, we look at 1 Corinthians 13 and we talk about love and we talk about faith, but we need to talk about hope more and hope in the midst of suffering. That, in fact, God is a God who redeems the suffering that we experience. So when we look at Genesis 50, you know, Joseph says, you sold me into slavery. That was excruciatingly painful for Joseph. He's never going to get those years back. But at the same time, he looks back on it and says, you meant it for evil, but God redeemed it somehow. He meant it for the redemption of a whole people so that they wouldn't die. I think that when we think about suffering, we have to teach about hope. We have to teach about the fact that God is in a covenant relationship with us, that he has linked himself to us for eternity, and that God is going to show up. Now, you know, God didn't give back Joseph all those lost years in prison, but at the same time, God is going to show up. God is present, and I think we need that kind of hope. Mm-hmm. Now, the last one I'll just mention is I think one of the other theologies that I think is so important is that we as Christians are in the business of helping each other out. You know, this was part of the big missionary movement that we not only brought the gospel, but we brought physical healing to people in the form of education and hospitals. And so we surround people, we support people when they are in difficult situations in our life. And we want to encourage people to reach out for that help. We provide help, but there are also people who are in that position of receiving help, right? That is part of what it means to be a Christian, that sometimes we receive the support of others, right? That's part of our theology of suffering. And so one of the things that I think is important in that is just that we can reach out for help. And I think they're a blind Bartimaeus, you know, and his community is trying to shush him up and saying, you know, be quiet. And blind Bartimaeus, just with no regard to his his the reputation of his community just keeps calling out to Jesus, Son of David, help me. And I think that that's another theology that is just so important for us to emphasize.
Yeah, I love this. This is, you know, this is one of the things we push here at CPYU, because I think we've had a bit of a drift in our youth ministry world away from teaching theology and teaching doctrine and going deep into the truths of God's word. So you're really talking here about filling the wells of our young people so that they have something rich to draw from. And by the way, I'm looking forward to that book with Scott Gibson. Scott's a friend of mine. We've had him on the podcast, and I miss him. I miss seeing him up there. You know what? I'm up there. So let me ask you, so that was prevention. Very quickly, intervention. You mentioned referrals. Would you just emphasize to youth workers, you know, we know that we're not counselors, but what do we have at arm's reach so that in the moment of crisis, what are the resources we need to be aware of so that in the moment of crisis, we can point people to those without having to say, well, I need to ask somebody or wait until tomorrow or next week?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very important. So it's interesting clergy that I've interviewed they routinely talk about how scary it is for them to not have resources to refer to. So, and I've had clergy say, you know, when they change maybe churches and they're in a new community, one of the first things they try to do is find a trusted fellow clergy member, who can help them start developing this referral list so that they are well-networked in the community. Mm. But one of the options I just want to emphasize here is the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 1-800-273-TALK, T-A-L-K. What's wonderful about the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is that it's a network of, you know, 160 or so crisis centers across the United States. And so if you call that 1-800 National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 1-800-273-TALK, you will get connected to your nearest crisis center who potentially knows your local resources. And so what's very helpful about knowing about the Lifeline is that you can call it with a youth who is struggling with suicidal thinking, or you could call it by yourself and ask some questions that you're wondering about, you know, like what will happen to this person if they call you or text you. By the way, the Lifeline has a line for veterans. It has a line in Spanish. It has a text capability. So so having a chance to using that Lifeline, I think, is a really valuable resource.
Yeah. And then the last question before we take a break here. So that was prevention, intervention, postvention. That moment when we enter into the presence of survivors who are grieving. Give me a clear sense. I mean, we feel paralyzed by that. We feel like we have to say something. We have to do something. What is the best thing to do? And is the best thing to do to not really say much of anything at all? Or what would you recommend to a youth worker?
Yeah. Well, I was going to say the one thing you don't want to do is start telling platitudes, right? God said to Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar in Job, he said, I'm angry with you and your two friends because you've not spoken of me what is right, right? So one of the things now that this book that's coming out, by the way, we have a lot of resources for youth workers in there. We have Bible studies for young people and adolescents. We have information you can give to family members following a suicide. I mean, we just have a lot of resources in that book. So, but one of the things that I would suggest that's very important is to If all you can think of is a platitude, then it's better to not say anything. One of the things that I think is most important is just to be present. And we talk about a ministry of presence. This is an opportunity for a ministry of presence. What's difficult about suicide is the stigma that's attached to it. And so we have a tendency to treat suicide deaths differently. And what happens as a result is that people who have experienced a suicide death tend to really feel the absence of support, right? We tend not to bring meals the same way we would bring following maybe a motor vehicle accident death. We might avoid the person as opposed to just sitting with the person and being willing to be there, being willing to make phone calls if needed for the person. So whatever you do for another death, it's very important to go ahead and do the same thing. The other thing a lot of people wonder about is, you know, do I mention the word suicide? Well, one of the problems with not mentioning the word is that it's more difficult to heal from it because all of the pieces of that can't be acknowledged, can't be talked about out loud. And so, of course, this is the family member's decision, whether they want to talk about the death as having been a suicide death or not. That is their decision. But if they are open to talking about this more openly, it is important to bring up suicide. And one of the things that you don't want to do is romanticize it in any way, make it seem or give attention to it. You want to be able to talk about it in a way specifically that emphasizes it's really too bad this person couldn't reach out for help because there is help. Look around here and see perhaps if we're talking about a memorial service, look around and see all the people that you could reach out to for help. Mm-hmm. So not romanticizing it, bringing it up, if the family allows, so that you can actually use this as a way to foster healing in the faith community, because the whole faith community is feeling guilty and worried and anxious about this. So talking about the fact that this was a suicide, if the family allows, using it as an opportunity to ask people to look around for helpers in the congregation. So using this as an opportunity also just to come alongside the family members who are just devastated. I mean, suicide leaves behind it just a wake of devastation. And these people, these family members need the support of the faith community.
Yeah, this is all such great advice. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to close out our conversation here, Karen, with some questions about getting guidance on, you mentioned helpers, you know, look around at the helpers here. How do we help someone in a suicide crisis? So we'll come back, get even more practical, and continue our conversation with Dr. Karen Mason. Stick with us.
If you enjoy listening to Youth Culture Matters and would like to support the ongoing efforts of this ministry, you can do so by visiting cpyu.org/giving to make a donation. Your prayers and financial support make this podcast possible.
Well, we want to finish out our conversation today with Karen Mason. As we've been talking about suicide in her book, Preventing Suicide, a handbook for pastors, chaplains, and pastoral counselors, we want to finish out by getting just practical. You know, in the last segment, Karen talked about how we can point survivors around to say, look, you know, there's resources here, there's help. But what does it mean to help? So how, Karen, do we help someone in a suicide crisis? Can you walk us through some of the steps we should take?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the myths I think that a lot of people have about suicide and preventing suicide is it's probably better not to ask or bring up the topic of suicide directly. So one of the first things I would say is it's always better to talk about it directly. And here's why. So kind of think about, you know, all the things that we know. We know stop, drop, and roll, right? If you catch on fire, stop, drop, and roll. There are so many things about suicide, though, that we've never been taught. We just don't know what to do when it comes to suicide because of the way this issue is stigmatized in our society. So one of the things that we don't know what to do is what happens when we have those thoughts ourselves, right? Our mom never sat us down in third, fourth grade and said, hey, look, here's what you're going to do if you have thoughts of suicide. So most people who are experiencing these thoughts are just very distressed by them, puzzled by them. You know, what do I do with these? I'm not really sure. And so having someone come to you and say, are you thinking about suicide, can actually be a relief for this person because they're not knowing what to do with these thoughts. So there's a lot of research that says that, you know, there's been a lot of research studies about asking directly about suicide. Does it increase distress? Does it increase likelihood of a person developing plans for suicide? And that is just not the case. So one of the first things I would suggest is to go ahead and ask, are you thinking about suicide? Now, you're not going to ask every person that question. You're going to ask people who somehow are giving off some signs of some sort, right? So maybe they talk about death. Maybe they talk about a sense of hopelessness. Maybe they talk about a sense of great despair. So in the context of that conversation, it's very much okay to ask, you know, wow, I've just been hearing you talk about just your sense of hopelessness here in this situation. Some people in that situation have thoughts of suicide. Are you having thoughts of suicide? Now, the reason I would suggest asking a very direct question like that is if you asked an indirect question like, are you just thinking about not being here next week? If they say yes, you're not really sure what that means, right? So that's why you want to ask directly. So the first thing I would say, what do you do if a suicidal person comes to you, reaches out to you for help? And you know, the research is that a fair number are going to do that. There are some people who won't reach out for help, and they aren't giving us that opportunity. And that's why we want that theology of being able to reach out, right? But the people who do reach out, we want to go ahead first of all and say, do you have thoughts of suicide? Now, the next kind of piece of that is, how serious is this thought of suicide? Because what happens for most people is that there's a whole maybe up to a year-long process from when a person starts thinking about suicide to when they actually make a serious plan and attempt suicide. So that's a process. So you want to try to figure out where on that continuum is this person? Do they have they had one or two thoughts? Do they think about it every day? Are the thoughts just so incredibly strong that they aren't sure they could resist it? Have those thoughts turned into actually planning? So one of the ways that I like to think about this is, say, for instance, an analogy could be planning a trip to France. So I could be wishing I could go to France, right? But never having, you know, made a plan, hey, I think I'll go next summer. That means I'm very early on in that planning process, right? I haven't even decided when I might do this. But if I start saying to you, hey, I'm thinking of going to France next summer, I'm going to go summer 2022 or something like that, then it's more likely that I'm actually going to take that trip to France. But once I buy those tickets, then it is pretty likely that I am going to take that trip to France. And what you're trying to figure out is, has this person bought the tickets yet, right? So you're trying to figure out where on this continuum does this person fall. So if the person has thoughts of suicide, one of the most important follow-ups, in my opinion, should be getting them connected to a mental health professional. Because for the most part, that suicidal thinking happens in the context of some kind of a mental health condition, whether it's anxiety or depression. So getting help for that is going to be important. So the thing that I would suggest, if they're anywhere on that continuum, is getting them help through connecting with a mental health professional. Sometimes it's hard for people to follow through on that. So helping them, you know, checking in with them every once in a while just to see if they've been able to follow through on that referral can be an important part of what you do. Now, there along that whole continuum, I would very definitely refer to a mental health professional. I would remember the 1-800-273-TALK National Suicide Prevention Lifeline as a possibility. So if you're wondering, boy, I'm not really sure where this person is on the continuum, call the 1-800-273-TALK National Suicide Prevention Lifeline with the youth who is struggling. Of course, with a young person under 18, you're going to want to get their parents involved, right? So the person who's responsible for making medical decisions about this minor child is going to need to be involved. But calling the 1-800-273-TALK number can be helpful in trying to negotiate, you know, how far along is this person and what should I do? The situation that you want to be especially aware of is a young person who is ready to follow through on their plans for suicide immediately after the conversation with you. In that case, you want to stay till help arrives. The help might come in the form of the parents. You want to get that person connected with either an evaluation at a hospital or sometimes different communities might have crisis centers, clinics that you can take the person to. So depending on what's available in your community, you just want to connect them with help and you want to stay with them until help arrives.
Excellent. That's so good. I really appreciate the work you've done in sharing this. This is, you know, youth workers, you need to realize if you have not encountered these situations already, chances are good that you will. That's part of doing ministry with kids who are broken and living in a broken world. And this is one helpful resource that we think you should have on your shelf. I know, Karen, that when this new book comes out in September, we're going to include a link to it. Give us the title again.
Preaching Hope in Darkness.
Preaching Hope in Darkness. And then you'll want that on your shelf next to her book, Preventing Suicide, a handbook for pastors, chaplains, and pastoral counselors. We know that this is a difficult topic, and we know you've done immense amounts of work on this, and we are grateful for you sharing not only your books, but coming on and helping us glean from your bank, your huge bank of wisdom and knowledge on this, some of what can be most helpful for us. Would you just share once more that phone line? I know that that's important.
Absolutely. 1-800-273-TALK, T-A-L-K, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. They just have an excellent website, too, so very worth going and looking at.
Great. And I know that, you know, when this new book comes out, I think we want to get you and Scott on together, so that would be good to have the two of you on together. Thank you so much. Those of you who have listened, I want to remind you that if you're listening on a player other than, or you're subscribing to Youth Culture Matters on a player other than the player on our page at cpyu.org, you'll want to come over to cpyu.org, find the player for this particular episode of the podcast, and beneath that, Chris Wagner will list anything that's been mentioned, the resources, the books, the phone numbers, the websites, anything that has been mentioned on this episode of the podcast, you'll find links to all of those things there. So, Karen, thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Walt.
Yes, thanks. And for all of you who joined us, thanks for being with us today. And we look forward to chatting with you again on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.